Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live a good life and to create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social, conscious, and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to part two of my fascinating conversation with Leslie Brissett, Director of Group Relations and Company Secretary of the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations. We will explore spirituality, belonging, and trees, amongst other things. So enjoy listening. I want to explore you have a religious side to your life. Spiritual, religious, how would you describe it?
Depends on the moment in time. I've always been curious about, and it's linked to this ontological question about, are we our bodies or not? So I think I'd say I'm a spiritual person who can see the benefit of all sorts of different systems of belief. But like I said, I fell in love with this Jesus character very early in life and thought, how do we live that way? Is it possible to be really loving to everyone, especially the people who hate you, which is what he advocated? Can we actually do that? Are there people on the earth who are prepared to invest in loving no matter what? And so I've kind of been looking for them in all sorts of places. And I came across quite early this group of Christians called the Mormons, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And I thought, there's something about them. I'm not quite sure what it is, but there's something. And then when I discovered that Joseph Smith, who was their founder, wrote a book in America in 1830 that said that Jesus came from Jerusalem and visited America and chose the Native American people, or the people who we'd now say were their ancestors, chose them to be his chosen people for the latter days. Now, what must it have been for this 15-year-old white boy to write that the Native Americans, who the British and the other Europeans who landed on America basically slaughtered or rounded up like cattle to live on reservations, that those people were God's chosen people?
Yeah, exactly.
So I figured there's something to this Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And then as I looked more and more into it, as a leadership model, and we talked about authority and authority relations, they work at the group level all the way through, right to the top of the church, where the president of the church works with two counselors, and they together, those three people, are called the first presidency. Mm-hmm. And they work prayerfully, meditatively, but they work as a whole. And then there's a council of the 12 apostles, and then there are cascades of, they call them 70s, and then it goes all the way down across the country, across the world. I think there's a lot to explore and learn from them. So, but I'm also deeply drawn to solitude, Simon. I was going to be a Carthusian monk.
Because
at one point I was thinking, why do people talk? You know, they spend so much time making air and not adding anything. Why do they talk? Actually, I could back then. I had the thought, I need never speak another word for the rest of my life, because there's nothing to say.
Well, it would also be a loss to the world, Leslie, because you also have a lot to say. Yeah, very beautifully. I'm very drawn to the monastics as well, and spent many a happy hour and day and week in monasteries, usually Benedictine, Camaldolese monasteries. Very drawn to the silence and the rhythm of the life, the simplicity and the rhythm of going to your cell and going to pray. Something very countercultural about that, but so powerful, I think.
Do you make time to go and get some recharge in the monastic.
Well, now?
Yeah.
It's something I miss. I have two young children, as you know, 5 and 6, I think, 5 and 7 in a week's time. And, yeah, with my work was before COVID was taking me to travel a lot. So that part of my life, which I always built into my being, had to stop really because I couldn't afford to take more time away from the family. So I have to do it in different ways. So I go into nature. I attend church most Sundays. So I find sacred spaces in the world, Leslie. I find sacred spaces in the world, whether it be a wood, a forest, a sea, a church, a temple,
yeah,
mosque. And I always have done it, even when I was an agnostic or anarchist, atheist, I would still find myself in a Zen temple or a mosque. It's interesting. I was always drawn, and I still drive my old friends mad. And as we go on holiday and I want to visit the cathedral or the sacred spaces, and
yeah,
it's a calling, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think there is something about the marketplace, you know, the hustle and bustle, the craziness of it all. And I've found over the years that too can be like a sacred space for me. I can just get in my zone of being with the watching of the dynamic of it and not to get whipped up, because it's almost like a projective process. You can feel the group, the crowd pulling you to move.
Yeah.
Yeah, come on, you've got to be in a rush with us, or you've got to join the queue for your sandwich or your coffee with us. And all those subtle cues of hypnotism that we take in unawares and think that that's who we ought to be. It's fascinating to take part in. We could keep talking for hours, couldn't we, Simon?
We could, yeah. Listening to you, there's patterns in your life, and I think we have similarities. I mean, you seem to be drawn to difference. You're a black body and you go and live in Arkansas. And when I was younger, I was a rugby playing male nurse in a kind of macho environment. And I was a nurse. Yeah. So I was a male in a female environment. And then later on, I've always been drawn to difference, always been drawn to live in places of difference or be in different spaces. And there's something which is enlivening about that, something kind of, and I'm wondering about you as well, because it sounds, you make unusual choices to become a Mormon, to go to Arkansas, to do lots of things which are not mainstream.
Yeah, I think the choices make me, and I just let myself be carried away with them. Somebody called me the will-o'-the-wisp. But I think there is something in what you're saying. And it's about, there's this principle from African or Egyptian development, and it was called Ma'at. And she was the goddess who represented balance and harmony. And I think there is something about difference that is back to that thing about how do the bits go together, live together, like the, you know, the yin yang symbol.
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's the black with the dot of white in it. It's the white with the dot of black in it, and they all are together.
Yeah.
So if we're interested in harmony and together, then if it's all a bit white, then I need to go a bit black. And if it's all a bit black, then I need to go a bit white. And if it's all a bit straight, then I need to go a bit gay. And if it's all a bit gay, I need to go a bit straight. And now, yeah. I've had gay friends who were like, no, I'd never sleep with a woman. I said, well, turn out the lights. How would you know? Because your body would tell you, thank you very much for that stroke or that touch. So I think there is a wisdom that is about blindness, which takes us into the realm of really feeling, you know?
I was just associating, again, like reflecting on different spaces I've been in. And one of the spaces I was in at a young age was an old-fashioned asylum. I worked as a psychiatric nurse, and it was just as the Victorian asylums were getting closed when they started putting patients into the community. And but I lived in an asylum for a few years during a training, and it was an extraordinary experience. And at one level, it was an asylum because you were set aside from the world in these lovely farmlands, and at another level, it was incredibly disturbing, totalitarian, totalizing institution. And not only for the patients, but for the staff. That was the thing which shocked me. I could see that the patients were institutionalized, but I don't think the staff realized just how institutionalized they were in this sort of total environment.
Mm.
And I suppose that they needed that degree of denial in order to take up their role.
Well, to actually work in that space, you did. Yeah. I mean, like for me, it was just too painful. It was like so painful, I had to get out. I mean, I was there for a year and a half, I think, and then I left, and I never worked in one again. And it was, and it stayed with me. And when I went to work in corporate businesses, I remember being asked in one of the major banks in Canary Wharf. I was talking to 200 leaders in a room, and they asked me they said, "You're unusual. You've come from the public sector and you're teaching us private sector people. It's usually the other way around. What can you teach us?" And I told them the story of the asylum. And I said that I look around your bank and I see 300 people in an open space office, everyone wearing dark suits, everyone sat at kind of the formulaic desks, and it takes me back to the asylum and the conformist culture. And I think you have to be very careful that there's this real conformity in these organizations. And I find it disturbing every time I see it, like smart people, well-paid people, like intelligent people, doing some interesting work. But there's a real conformity in society in some places. And I find it very disturbing whenever I get close to it.
Yeah.
I think all the systems tend towards totalizing.
Yeah.
And I think it's that. Did you ever see the C.S. Lewis when he talked about the lure of the inner ring?
No.
He gave this wonderful speech to a graduating class at King's College in the 40s. And he was saying, of all the things that you need to look out for, and the most captivating, the most scintillating thing that will suck your integrity is that desire to belong.
Mm-hmm.
Because on one level, we all have it, because we all know there was a time, this is a complete supposition, but there was a time before we were here where we have the experience of being unified and connected and belonging unreservedly. And so as we're born into life, we have that pull. And in the world of work and life, that pull is activated by forces that want to control us. And they will, it's closely linked to the idea of pride.
Yeah.
You want to belong, you want to have your moment, and certainly you want to belong to that place where the secret stuff happens, the inner ring. And that, I think that's partly what's in the Lord of the Rings thing, my precious.
Yeah, and I think there's also, I think in a world where there's so much feel precarious now, whether it's through viruses or whether it's through racism or whether it's through economic stressors, whether it's through environmental change, that there's a seems to me that there's a very strong feeling of being precarious, and I think people identify with a fantasy past, a nostalgia for a fantasy past where there was purity, where it was more simple, where we did belong, and it was a comfortable belonging. And I think that's what a lot of populist politicians sell. It's a snake oil, really, that vote for me and I can return you to this Garden of Eden where everything was simple and you belong to your tribe and the other tribe won't steal your enjoyment. They won't run off with your pleasure. And of course, it's a fantasy because diversity is always been with us.
And at the same time, there is this force, and it's linked to the the point you were making about the asylum and that the workers had to almost forget that they too were institutionalized, is that in order to really engage with the murderous, the necrophilic, the destructive, there has to be a degree of forgetfulness.
Yeah.
And I think it's in the Greek myth of Thanatos and Lethe, you know, that river of forgetfulness that came out of the cave where Thanatos lived. And I think that's partly what we're is being mobilized for us all now with the virus and the unexplained deaths. And we're still sending our children to be soldiers to murder other people's children. And we're in a death camp march as a species. And I think identity is evoked as that rallying cry for war.
Yeah.
So there is a fanatic force that is unleashed across the world, really. And we're all susceptible because we want to belong, to join in the march and the cry for killing. And I think this is where that softer, quieter ushering of love or eros is harder to hear. It's harder to hear, and it takes moments of stillness and quiet and openness. It's why I love trees, Simon. I love trees.
Me too.
You go and you stand at a tree and it's been there silently present. But maybe it's not silent. Maybe it just communicates at a frequency that our ears can't hear. Maybe they're singing or speaking to each other, but we can't hear it. And
I was reading. I was reading Freud again, trying to make some sense of the state of the world and thinking about his work on group psychology. And he posed the idea that the groups held together, like, by identity, that we identify with each other to form a group. And he says that the bonding in that group is eros, that it's love that holds us together. But that only works when there's an out group to project upon our aggression and our negativity. And a follower of Freud wrote that there's two types of out groups. One is a friendly out group. So you see the other and you create your identity based on not being them, but but they're friendly. You know, it's like a rivalry, maybe football teams or something. You know, there's a rivalry, and then there's another out group which becomes the enemy, and that's the real danger that flips into the enemy. And I think we can see how that works a lot in society at the moment.
Mm. Yeah, and it's how I think that's the key for diversity, is to say different but free to be,
yeah,
rather than different and should be deleted,
yeah, and to accept that difference is actually a living part of who we are, because there's the idea of like pure equality or some perfect place where there is no difference. It is a fantasy as well. So it's like how we work with that difference, how we kind of make that a creative difference, how we work through our own struggles with our own differences internally as well. I mean, I think psychoanalysis really helps that as well, that it's not just a difference out there, there's a difference in here, you know, the conscious and the unconscious playing with each other, and the ego and the superego having their games, and all our internal kind of cells fighting and struggling and enjoying all at the same time.
But I think we need to put the point of caution in the air that says that surfaces the fantasy that we will get beyond it and get to a place where it's all love.
Yeah.
Because that isn't balance.
No. And it becomes a shadow. As you know, I was a Quaker for many years. I'm still a Quaker, although I don't attend meetings. There's not a big meeting where I am. But and I belong to the Church of Ireland at the moment, but I had a friend in Liverpool. He was a dean of Liverpool Cathedral, and he was a fine man. And his sister was a Quaker. And he said to me, "Simon, Quakers, the most aggressive people on earth." And I actually thought about it. I thought, actually, it's quite right. The levels of passive aggressiveness, which you get in pacifist groups, whether it's Quakers or anarchists or whatever it is, peace groups, you know, CND and stuff, the levels of passive aggressiveness which come through are amazing.
And I think that's what happens when Dione Hills, a colleague at the Institute, she talks about spiritual bypassing, mm-hmm. where lots of people get into this mental state where they think they should be more advanced and more spiritual than they really are. And when they say spiritual, they mean all kind, all beneficent, all accepting. And yeah. so you get this strange, odd, lack of integrity way of behaving.
Yeah.
Where people pretend, oh, yes, we're perfectly okay with that, but you can feel them seething with poison underneath.
Yes. Yeah.
That's where the microaggressions come from.
Yeah. That's right. Now, spirituality is a big challenge. I mean, when you talk about religion, spirituality, when people ask me about it, it's quite problematic because so often it can be instrumentalized. You know, people in business talk about spirituality in business and that gives you increased profits, and there's the whole movement around spirituality. It's quite a troubled area, I think, at the moment. Like people they point to religion as kind of a bad thing, that kind of old-fashioned thing called religion, and power spiritual. But it's something which is being lost in that journey as well, I think, and it becomes like a narcissistic spirituality as well, where it's, you choose this bit and that bit, but you don't actually do the deeper work and work through the struggle of what it means to work on yourself through a religious practice. And you see all of that out in the world.
I think, though, in a way, it's like we're going through a collective surfacing. So all the stuff, all the lies that we've been raised with, all of our conditioning, our collective conditioning, in the face of whatever's emerging, we can't hide in the conditioning anymore. And so the lies, the cruelty, the brutality that our social systems have enacted, perpetrated, orchestrated, and hidden from us now are being revealed. And people, at one hand, are intrigued, and on the other they're terrified, and it's like we've all gone to watch a really gory video nasty, and we're covering our eyes. We're in there, we want to see, but we don't really want to see it.
Yeah.
And you know, if you think about what organized religions have done, if they could lay on the streets all the bodies that they've murdered. I saw that film, what was it called? Philomena. Did you ever see Philomena?
I did, yeah. Yeah, very moving.
Where basically the church were killing babies.
Yeah, yeah.
In enormous numbers and then burying them.
Yeah.
And not telling people. You add to that what they did to the babies that they let survive. What nuns were being used for. It's awful.
Yeah.
But to really make the time to look at the horror story, not to beat anybody up for it, not to punish them saying you should have known better or you shouldn't have let it happen, but to really, like you do in an analysis, lie on the couch and let it all out.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I'm observing is very much this, and I talk about, I was working with a global tech company yesterday, and they asked me to address Black Lives Matter, and it was in American HQ. And I was talking about a return of the repressed, and it's what you're saying. These things which went out, slavery, colonialism, the Catholic Church, abuse, unless they've dealt with it, these things return, that this repression doesn't work. It comes back, and it comes back, and it's repetition after repetition. And it, haunts us really. And as you say, still like in Ireland, where the Catholic Church, it hasn't really done the work it needs to do, you know, and it returns. And, you know, immigrants in Ireland, they get treated really badly in institutions at the moment. Mm. Hope it's going to change it, but it's horrible what happens to immigrants here. It's dehumanizing. And it's like, after everything which has gone before, haven't we learned, you know? But because it's not been addressed, this repressed comes back and haunts us again, and it gets repeated.
Yeah.
I think, you know, it's partly what Freud was trying to allude to with civilization and its discontents. Yeah. But moving here to Arkansas, I've become a bit obsessed about hunting. And adding to that, just basically murder. If you think about how many animals we kill and the way that we kill them, and that killing takes place out of sight. It's not like in the old days where you'd go to a market and there'd be a box of chickens in a thing and somebody'd wring its neck, or like you do in other parts of the world. You know, in our Western meat processing, they even call it processing.
Yeah.
We are really cruel. And I think we have to own it, whether we eat the animals or not, are really cruel.
Yeah.
And where does all of that cruelty get located?
Yeah.
You know, so our psychic apparatus that's having to defend us against the cruelty that forms the bedrock of what is in our fridge and our cupboards, we can't contain.
Yeah. Yeah, and that the Hindus and the Hare Krishnas, they teach us about this. I remember being with the Krishnas on some festival, and I've been visiting the Krishnas ever since. And they teach about this. So just the karma, just the mass killing of animals in this way, it actually changes you as a human race, and it does something to you. And I think, you know, I think there's a truth in that.
Yeah. So when we ask the question where we began, you know, what does it mean to be human? I think there's a lot of people in apparent human bodies who may not be human anymore.
Yeah.
And how do we deal with that?
Well, we end our podcast, Leslie. I think, as you say, we could talk forever. This has been fascinating. So thank you. I like to end by asking guests, have they... reflecting on the conversation, what would help us live a good life and create the good society? What could you say to our audience?
To take some time to slow down, which has been part of the gift of this corona time, and to take note of the trees in your environment and embrace them with wonder. What do they know? What do they think? What do they feel? Because there is as alive as we are. And if we can find our humanity to connect with them as fellow earthlings, I have real curiosity about what we might unleash on this planet in terms of sustainability.
Well, that's a lovely lovely way to end our podcast, Leslie. Your beauty and your wisdom shine through, so keep shining.
Thank you, Simon. I'm just your mirror. I'm just your mirror.
Lovely to talk with you. We'll do this again in a while.
Yeah. Okay. Okay,
well.
Take care. Peace.
Thank you for listening to Edgy Ideas. If you enjoyed our podcast and would like more information about our coaching, training, and events, please contact simon@analyticnetwork.com. or go to www.analyticnetwork.com. Thank you for listening.